Professor Balakian, welcome to SBS Radio Armenian program.
Thank you. Good to be talking with you.
Professor Balakian, your book titled Black Dog of Fate received good reviews and won many prizes. Did you expect such a success?
Well, you know, I think when you're writing a book, your basic devotion is to the craft, to making the best piece of art that you can, the best piece of work that you can, because the book's success or failure really rests in how well you can create an effective piece of literature if you're a writer. So I wasn't really thinking about public reception for the 7 years I was working on this book. And obviously I was happy that the book has gotten the reception that it has. Everywhere people seem to be reading it. Now it's out in the United States in paperback, and it's already in a fourth printing. And what really pleases me is that the mainstream American audience is so taken by the history of the Armenian genocide and by the larger courage and endurance of the Armenian people as an ancient civilization, having survived through so many catastrophes in the 20th century.
Why did you decide to write the book? Was it for literary purposes, or you tried to share your experiences with other Armenians in the same situation?
Well, I would remind, you know, my listeners out there that I am an American poet, an Armenian-American poet, and so I've been writing, you know, since my early 20s. I've published 5 books of poems and other critical works, other scholarly and critical essays and articles and books, so that I'm a writer. And as a writer and as a poet, I came to a certain place in my life where I felt that I had a story to tell. And I wanted to tell that story, both an American story about growing up in the affluent suburbs of Teaneck and Tenafly, New Jersey, in the post-World War II period, and a story that would open up into what would become a family history, and then, of course, a history of the Armenian genocide, and even further, a history about the Turkish government's corrupt efforts to stifle that history, silence it, and deny it worldwide. So that I wanted to write that book because it was in me and because I'm a writer. And me, really, I wanted to share it with the non-Armenian world every bit as much as the Armenian world, because I feel that the main project for people who are of Armenian descent is to be heard by the mainstream.
What's the significance of the title, Black Dog of Fate?
Well, as readers will see when they read the book, that in the opening chapter, my grandmother, I'm baking Chureg with my grandmother in the kitchen. I'm about 7 or 8 years old, and while we're baking, and I'm in my baseball uniform, what we call Little League baseball. I don't know if you have the same thing in Australia. I'm in my baseball uniform, and my grandmother begins to tell me a story, a folk tale, and it's an Armenian folk tale full of ancient Armenian imaginative richness, and it deals with the issue of fate. And I won't try to explain the whole parable, but I would say to the reader that he or she should take this parable and pull it through the story so that it reverberates and echoes in a broad symbolic way. But I wanted the title of the book to resonate with something that was Armenian and folkloric.
How big was your grandmother's influence on you?
Well, you know, I guess it's safe to say that my grandmother is sort of the most important figure in my memoir, and her influence on me was huge. Even though she died when I was 13, the impact she left on me is still being felt. And she was a genocide death march survivor, and everybody in her home city of Diyarbakir in southeastern Turkey today, once ancient Armenia. Everybody in her home city was deported. Everybody in her family murdered and executed on August 1st, 1915. And she and her first husband and her 2 infant daughters were put on what the Turks called the deportation march. She and the 2 daughters survived. Her first husband did not. And when she arrived in Aleppo, Syria, sometime in the fall of 1915, this genocide widow, stripped of everything, family, homeland, possessions, friends, loved ones, this genocide widow, 25 years old, living in the famine-ravaged refugee quarter of Aleppo, began to compile a human rights suit against the Turkish government for crimes against humanity. And this suit was filed in the United States in 1920 when she arrived here. I didn't know most of this growing up because my grandmother never spoke openly about her past, but she conveyed to me in ways that I've come to call encoded. In encoded ways, like through folk tales and dreams and parables, she conveyed to me the trauma of her life. And that trauma became, at a certain point in my life, like a thread that I began to follow through a maze or a labyrinth so that I could figure out what had really happened to her and to my ancestors.
That must have been one of the first lawsuits against the Turkish government.
I think it may be the first human rights suit ever in the century. As far as I know, I don't know of any others, and I've been asking around. Nobody can tell me. So it's a remarkable a feat of moral courage and witness that my grandmother performed.
She must have been a remarkable woman.
Decades before, she was indeed. Decades before the term human rights was even a legal or international concept. Remember that the UN Genocide Convention doesn't exist until 1948. And here's my grandmother in 1915. Already beginning to think in these broad and universal ways. So it's very powerful.
Second or third generation Armenians, how do they identify with your story?
Well, I have received a lot of mail from around the country, and so many Armenian Americans identify with my story. They feel, too, that nobody spoke openly about the past, that the past was always spoken in more complex, encoded, or muffled ways. So a lot of Armenians identify with it. I'm sure that my story isn't the only, you know, model of an Armenian story, because I know in many families the facts of this history were spoken very, loudly to people. But for many, many Armenians, they were not spoken openly.
Professor Balakian, you heard about the Armenian genocide when you were in your mid-20s. Do you think this is possible with today's youth?
Well, I think today it's a very different world, and I think that people, we live in a different kind of cultural climate where there's great interest first in the many cultures of the planet. We live in a very global age, and secondly, we live in a very human rights-oriented age where the Holocaust has created a huge discourse and arena for inquiry and knowledge and curriculum surrounding Holocaust studies and correspondingly genocide studies, so that in schools now all over America, the Armenian genocide and the Holocaust are being taught. And the Holocaust, of course, has had a much bigger and longer tradition in the last two decades. But now the Armenian genocide is becoming a very important part of American education, beginning stage. I don't mean to suggest that every school in America teaches this history, but it's beginning now. And so I feel that students and young adults and even kids, children, begin to learn about these things much earlier than they used to. And not only Armenian children, but American children or mainstream children, whatever your culture may be, Australian, Chinese, French, however it may be. I don't know about Chinese because I don't know what's really going on in China. But I know in Western Europe and I'm sure in Australia and the States that human rights histories are becoming an important part of knowledge.
Professor Black, and these young Armenians, the second or third generations, probably they don't speak Armenian. You don't speak Armenian?
I don't speak Armenian, no, but my daughter is learning.
What being an Armenian means to you without the language? You know, sometimes I hear that young Armenians here in Australia don't participate at community activities because they don't speak or understand Armenian, and gradually they lose total contact with the community. How did you sort of overcome the language difficulty?
Well, I can't really give you a universal answer to that, but I hope that my book suggests that you don't need to speak the language to become a leader on some of these issues. So, I think that language is one reality, but I think that the mind and the soul are very deep parts of ourselves, and so that we carry the culture forward in many ways. And I think that Armenian diasporan communities should be very open to the flexibility of diasporan identity. And sometimes the best thing is to discover it on your own when you're ready to.
Is Black Dog of Fate the Armenian version of Roots?
Well, I won't try to summarize my book. It has some dimension of that in it, a discovery of the past, but it's a universal story about a boy growing up in a world of double culture, that is American culture in this case and Armenian culture. And I think it's the doubleness that gives it its universality, so that I hope, Australians can read it, and the Chinese and the Indians and the Russians can read it and all feel that they feel some connection to growing up with double cultures and discovering things that have traumatized your family and things that have been locked away. And I think those are very universal situations. I would just say, too, that my book comes out in Holland next week, and I'm going to Holland for the Dutch publication, and it'll come out in Germany in 99. So, there seems to be international interest in my book.
Professor Balakian, you led a campaign against Hit Lowry. What's the current situation in American universities?
The current situation, short of my having to probably try to summarize this large history, which we may not have time to do at this moment, but the Turkish government has been placing unqualified people in American universities through Turkish funding of chairs, and this is outrageous. And many scholars and writers around America have protested this vehemently, and it has drawn a lot of media attention. The Heath Lowry scandal at Princeton University was covered by the New York Times, the Boston Globe, the Chronicle of Higher Education, and many papers around America. And the Lowry scandal showed very much that Turkey is trying to buy influence in the academy for the sake of revising and rewriting its history of human rights crimes. The genocide of the Armenians, of course, the annihilation of the Greeks, the destruction of the Kurds. None of this is allowed in Turkish studies. We would welcome real Turkish studies. That would be just great. But we don't have any. We just have state-sponsored propaganda. So I'm afraid that Princeton has not behaved well. Nothing has really happened. And Lowry has been disgraced. Princeton has been exposed, but he has not lost his job. And yet pressure continues to be put on Princeton by people in the outside world and by alumni who are dissatisfied. So we're doing something good. We're educating through these nasty and what I would call evil acts of Turkish denial. We get a chance to educate the world about an important human rights history.
You were telling me you had some connections with Australia. Are you still keeping in touch with your relatives?
Well, my cousin, the granddaughter of Hagop Balakian, who is part of my family, the Balakians of Tokat, and then of Boli, so then of Constantinople, ended up in Melbourne in the 1930s, and I have a number of Hagop Balakian's letters back to my grandfather, Diron Balakian, and to my great-uncle, the Bishop Krikoris Balakian, who wrote, of course, the famous genocide memoir, Armenian Golgotha, or High Golgotha. And so that those Balakians are there, and my cousin and I emailed each other. She said she saw my picture on the Internet or something with an advertisement for my book, and she said, "I saw your eyes, and I realized that we're related." And indeed we are. So I would love to get to Australia sometime and reconnect.
Professor Balakian, thank you for your time and the interview.
Thank you. We'll be in touch. I can fax you some things.
Thanks.